Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Hello. Hello to the best audience in the entire field of psychology, psychiatry, mental health, some aspects of spirituality as well, which we'll get into today. I'm going to just skip talking about something dreary like how bad the antipsychotic drugs are and jump right into introducing my guest. And I think we're going to have a show that really emphasizes the positive. Donna, are you there? Hello, Donna. I'm not connecting to my guest.
I am here. Can you hear me?
I gotcha.
All right.
Well, listen, I don't want to miss Donna Rockwell, and I don't want you to miss Donna Rockwell, side D. One of the more interesting things about Donna is that she has been a news anchor person. She knows celebrities. I don't think I'm included in that group of celebrities. She knows real celebrities. She has taken her psychology career in a number of interesting ways. I'll let her tell you when we get around to it how she practices now and how she can be available. I think she can be available to people all over. But what I'm really interested in is her emphasis on mindfulness. We don't talk enough about it on the show. I probably don't know enough about it. But I think in my own way, I am mindful, and I'll talk about that later with you. But say hello to Donna Rockwell, Psy D. One of her bases is in New York City. And Donna, hi.
Hi. It's lovely to be on your show, Peter. I've been on once before, and it's nice to be back.
Yes, Donna and I are friends, but we're the kind of friends that just do it through the heart and don't talk very often, as you were kind of saying today when we connected around the show. Donna, do you want to just jump in and talk about mindfulness and how you got involved in it, what it means to you, how it fits into psychotherapy? Because you're a trained psychotherapist. You know about psychoanalysis and you know about cognitive therapy and you know tons of stuff. Where does mindfulness fit into all this?
Well, I was actually interested in mindfulness before I even thought of becoming a clinical psychologist. As you said, I worked in Washington, D.C. for CNN when it first started in 1980. And I covered Capitol Hill for them, and I was Daniel Shore's producer for the network. I worked for the NBC affiliate in Washington, and I had a pretty intense life. My mind was always going. And so I was actually introduced to meditation and mindfulness first as a sort of intervention for the runaway mind and runaway lives, the hamster wheel that many of us find ourselves on. And I found it as just the most perfect intervention for that. Being type A and working in politics in D.C., it's very, very fast-paced. And it's very easy, I think, to lose oneself. So it was only after that that I ended up moving to Michigan, ended up going back and getting a degree in psychology, and ended up writing my master's thesis on the experience of meditation as a form of self-discovery. Because what I saw was that mindfulness was a psychotherapeutic intervention. And I kept asking myself, and you know, anyone who would listen to me, why is mindfulness not psychotherapy? Why are they not using everything I've learned about mindfulness and meditation to help people get better connected to themselves existentially, emotionally, physiologically, spiritually, mentally. Why? And it's really been a shock to me to see how the rest of the world, I feel, has kind of caught up with my inquiry, because mindfulness is just everywhere now. And I guess I was on the right track with that, that mindfulness is a way to come to understand ourselves and hold ourselves in a healing space more readily. And, you know, I think that in the context of clinical psychology and helping people with mental wellness, it really behooves a person to understand their own dynamics, you know, how their mind works, how the brain works. And I think that our education system could probably go a long way and is changing ever so rapidly to include an awareness of mindfulness in pre-K and kindergarten and all through the school system, mindfulness in schools. And Goldie Hawn has started the Hawn Foundation, where they do what's called a mind-up program with preschool and elementary school students. So the world is really abuzz with this new awareness and all the new research. Richard Davidson out of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with underwriting by the Dalai Lama, who has asked him to look into the science of compassion, the science of kindness, the science of self-compassion, and how healing that is for people.
Well, this is already extremely interesting. You're connecting mindfulness to something that I'm deeply aware of, which is the importance of empathy, compassion, and kindness. Kindness, I think, is so extremely important, as much as we can, even in the public arena where it's so difficult at times, even in conflict, and absolutely in our love relationships. So what's the connection for you between mindfulness and compassion and kindness?
Well, what's, you know, very interesting and true is that if, as people, we got to see a transcript of our thoughts during a given day, we would see how very unkind we are to ourselves. We're very down-putting, you know, you even hear people say out loud, oh, I'm so stupid, that's so stupid, I'm such an idiot, I hate myself. I mean, it's just very clear that we are unkind to ourselves. Thus, we cannot be kinder to other people than we treat our very own selves. So the link between mindfulness and kindness is that my experience has been sitting on a cushion and meditating. And what is meditation except sitting in observance of one's own mind and what arises in one's mind? You come to actually hear this transcript or see this transcript of your cognitive thoughts all day in real time. So you start seeing, wow, did I really just say that to myself? Wow, do I really think this thought all the time? Oh my goodness, I'm so harsh with me. Listen to the tone of voice I'm speaking to myself with in my own head. So there is so much sort of awakening in meditation practice, in mindfulness, to our own way of operating all the time that does not stand us in good stead, that does not lead us toward wellness, but leads us more toward pathology and dysfunction. You know, I think the most well we can be is being the kindest we can be to ourselves and therefore to others. All we really want is to connect with one another, but we keep in these habitual patterns, these learned behaviors of pushing ourselves away from ourselves, almost disembodied, and pushing other people away from us. And what mindfulness does is it kind of gives you a bird's eye view of your own racket, so that as you go upon your everyday life off of the meditation cushion or outside of the meditation hall, it occurs to you as you're walking down the street, oh, I'm doing that thing again. So it's really, I mean, I cannot speak more highly of how profound a practice it is for waking up, which means cutting through all of the discursiveness, the runaway mind, the storylines and narratives we find ourselves traveling down that have no basis in reality whatsoever. So what mindfulness and meditation does is it helps you catch yourself quicker. One of the main points is that if you look at how your mind operates, and this is only because we're survival animals, we're trying to avert extinction of ourselves, is that we are either worried about what happened in the past or we're catastrophizing about the future. And we're never actually really in the here and now of the moment. And what mindfulness and meditation does is it trains the mind and the brain to come back from discursiveness, to come back from that runaway mind, to come back from that kite tail of a narrative that really has very little basis in reality, to what's happening right here, right now. And just as a shortcut to tell you, that's through the five senses. So immediately you come back and you hear the birds singing, or you smell dinner cooking, or you see the light coming in the window. You know, you're grounded in your five senses, and then you're back in the now, not catastrophizing or worried about the future or, you know, regurgitating what happened in the past. And so that is the freedom. That's really being kind to yourself. If you are willing to go through the hard work of training yourself of how to come back into reality from being really lost to the very present moment, to the joys and beauties, the kindness, the compassion that's available because you're too busy worried, either worried about the past or worried about the future. So sort of mindfulness and meditation is like a spaceship back from worried mind to present mind.
I think it's wonderful. It's lovely to hear you talking about it. I think that much of what I've gained in the way of mindfulness has come from, and I'd be interested in your feelings or thoughts about this, come from two places. One, as a therapist, it quickly became apparent to me that I had to be in tune to the people who were coming to me, that I couldn't react with anxiety to their anxieties. I couldn't react to anger with their anger. I couldn't react to their feelings of helplessness with frustration and things like that. And that the best I could do for them was to be in touch with them, to be alert, to be caring, to be kind, and to ultimately just be there for them. And I think that has helped me learn to be that way for myself. It's hard to be mean to yourself when your job is to be kind to somebody else. And the other place that I know I've gotten it a lot from is my relationship with Ginger, because we get very uncomfortable when the other's being unkind. So if I start doing that kind of stuff you described earlier, and sometimes I'll get into that, we do things that most people would consider were extraordinarily stressful things, taking on the establishment. Even now, we're once again under attack, but managing to stay in touch with what matters, which is love for each other, keeping our own emotional relationship to the world based on our own spirituality, things like that. And it sounds very much like mindfulness, only being done in relation to others. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that is being mindful. It's sort of like, on the one hand, you know, you can do two things at one time. You can watch the arising experience of stress, and understand how all-consuming that can be. And yet, on the other hand, you can remember this is stressful, and we love each other, and sometimes energy is such that I'm going to feel irritated, or she's going to feel irritated. And to be able to do two things at one time, to hold two awarenesses at one time, is extremely mindful. And I always talk to my clients ever since, is that we suffer primarily because we try and collapse a paradox and make one thing be true, where we can really have two things be true. One thing is true is that I love my wife, Ginger. We are a gift to each other in this world, and we were lucky to find each other. And on the other hand, we're working and climbing Mount Everest together in a meaningful pursuit of what we think is important to leave behind on this earth as our life's work. And that's going to have stresses with it. So if you can live in those two truths and not to have to collapse the paradox and say, oh, if we loved each other, then these feelings would never arise, that's not true. They will arise. We're human. So what you're doing in your relationship with Ginger and your awarenesses you both are able to hold simultaneously is what mindfulness is all about. So absolutely. The other thing that I think is so important, and you touch upon it, is that we do have these emotions, and we are relational beings. What's also true is part of what underrides that relational engagement is our brain. And when we are feeling stressed or we're feeling fear, we are in a fight or flight response. Our amygdala is engaged. Our prefrontal cortex is unavailable to us, which is where executive reasoning, wisdom, emotional intelligence is located. And we are unable to access that. Like if you're running away from a lion in the jungle, you're not going to be able to figure out that 2 + 2 = 4, because that's not what your brain needs to do right then. It needs to get out of dodge. It needs to run away. So in our modern era, we are constantly activated in that way. Our amygdala, which is the most reptilian part of the brain by the brainstem, gets activated, and we're immediately defending ourselves. Or we're thinking about the past, or we're catastrophizing about the future, and we're not in the present moment, which I think is probably true as I think about it now, is only ever just love, is only ever just compassion, is only ever just kindness. When we are in a state that's not that, it's because it's covered over with confusion, or what they call veils of obscuration, you know, conflictive emotions. What's underneath all of that is just kindness, love, and compassion. So when you're helping your clients by staying present with what they're feeling rather than correcting them or trying to get them out of there, you're showing them that in this present moment there's love and compassion and empathy and heart, and you share that heart space with them. So mindfulness is really just about coming back to that heart space and becoming better and better at it, so that when one realizes that they're in a fight or flight response, the amygdala has been activated. I mean, I do this now. I have no control right now. I'm just feeling very scared and very hypervigilant and very defensive. And so I know my amygdala has been activated. And let me just breathe and come back to my breath, and I take a few minutes and I just breathe. I feel my five senses. I see, you know, the spring day. I see the green plants. I see the orange flowers. I ground myself in the now, in the present moment. My physiology is calmed down, and then I'm actually able to come back to prefrontal cortex, executive reasoning, wisdom mind, because my amygdala is calmed down. See, for me, it just comes down to the very basics. You know, how can I become a samurai warrior of my own mind, of my own brain, of my own being in the world? And I know that when I'm feeling activated, I need to be with my breath and be mindful, calm down my physiology. My prefrontal cortex is back. I have access to wisdom mind, and I can proceed like a human being. And so I just think there's so much promise in this approach.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that mindfulness, in terms of learning it in the fashion you're describing, the solitary fashion, one of the great advantages of it, I would think, is that it removes the excuses we all have for feeling badly because of other people, because of the environment around us, and because of suffering in the world, and so on. Because I deeply believe that one of the most important achievements of wisdom and of being able to, in fact, act under stress is to know that you are the samurai, you are in charge, you are the master of your spiritual state. And of course, there are limits on it, because we're not God. We're not, who knows if even God is immune to all the suffering. But we can get to a place where we can be aware of the suffering of other people on a larger scale. We can be aware that our relationship with someone is provoking us or stirring us up, but we can come back to taking responsibility for our own spiritual state. And I think in many ways that's the most important realization a person makes in therapy with me, is that they really are in charge of their own lives, their own choices, and to a great extent, especially with practice, their own feelings, and that they can come back to being loving, thoughtful, kind, and understanding, that it's in their power to be there. And I would think that mindfulness would be a great place to train for that, because you're separating yourself largely from any negativity in your environment. So is that part of it?
Yes, except that, you know, it's like I am a big proponent to that point of going on longer retreats. I did a 7-day retreat, my first one last November, which, you know, was just remarkable as far as being able to sit and watch the movie projector of your own life and your own mind. You know, it's like a real boot camp or a real basic course in what I think about all day. Yes, it does take you away from yourself. But what ends up happening so interestingly is that all of these negative thoughts that you're thinking, you over time soften and become more and more gentle with yourself. So it's more like, as Pema Chodron, one of my favorite writers, Chodron, I love any book she's ever written, so whatever title speaks to a person, they can pull off the shelf or put on their Kindle. But she talks about learning how to hold ourselves in the cradle of loving kindness, you know, and that by watching these thoughts arise and by seeing how hard we are on ourselves, over time there's a tendency to become more gentle with ourselves, to parent ourselves very tenderly. And say, like, ah, baby, you know, that it's hard, you know. Wow, look at that thought. And so rather than becoming more critical of ourselves, we become more gentle with ourselves. And yes, in the notion of being a samurai warrior, to understand that that is a lifetime journey. It's just another racket to say, I want to be better and I want to be better now. Or, you know, I want to be a samurai warrior and I want to be one now. Really, all of life is training to become a samurai warrior in deeper and deeper levels over time. And so, you know, it's interesting because wanting to be a samurai warrior and wanting to be one now is sort of almost maybe a little arrogant, you know? Like, maybe it's all about the hard work over all of life, of just learning to become more and more present and more a samurai warrior of our own mental apparatus. In mindfulness practice and meditation, when you find that you're lost in thought, as the instruction goes, and then you very gently return your mind to the present moment without all of the self-flagellations and negative self-appraisals of yourself, and just simply return to right now and find yourself lost, and then simply return to right now and find yourself lost 2 minutes later and simply return to right now. The good news, and what always was so exciting to me as a scientist, was that what one was doing was building a new neural network in the brain, was creating different neuron and dendrite structures in the brain that allow a person over time, just like the development of any muscle, like learning how to become a marathon runner, so you build up the muscles in your legs to be able to do that, in your mind, by coming back and coming back, this whole neural network then gives us that power. When we are in a conflict or we are feeling a relational stress event, to be able to activate, to use that new neural network of simply returning to now. So you stay in the ability of having your prefrontal cortex activated, your executive reasoning, your wisdom mind, your presence. And the amygdala doesn't get charged up. Because why? Because over all that time, you've actually developed a new neural network. You've developed the capacity within your brain, in the cortical layer of your brain, to return to now. It becomes another habit. We have lots of habits. We can either, as you say, in the notion of self-responsibility, choose to promote within ourselves good habits or let ourselves continue down the road of bad habits. But it's all habit of mind. So we're always choosing what habit of mind we want to promote. So it's very difficult to just arrive upon this place without doing the legwork or the muscle work or the reps of creating this ability, and that would be by doing meditation practice or going to a local mindfulness class. But doing things in one's life that are actually mindful interventions. And I know you know that I just have a book chapter out in a book where this is all outlined. And also I have a blog on Huffington Post, Mindfulness in Everyday Life, or just Googling my name, Donna Rockwell, where I write about a lot of these things. And the reason I'm bringing that up is because we need to know what to do. It's one thing to theoretically consider something, but we need to do the actual everyday practices to create that neural structure to access.
Can you talk about how mindfulness affects your relationships, either personally or through your experience with clients?
Well, you know, I did my I did a research study with 6 years worth of mindfulness students on with who are clinical psychology students, doctoral students, who are going to become therapists. And what they reported was they did a mandatory 10-week mindfulness class. And what they reported was that at the end of the class, so we did a first day pre-test, we did a last day of class post-test, and a seven-month out post-test. And we found that their levels of mindfulness stayed consistent over even 7 months out. And what they reported to me in working with clients was that, so beautifully, that they were able to stay present with crisis-level affect from clients in ways they never could before. That they were able to find that they had kind of mentally left the room, but were able to very gently return to the here and now of the client, that they were no longer judging what the client was saying, but were able to simply enter into the space the client was creating in describing their lives and just journey with them without a lot of their older preconceived notions.
A lot of this is very similar, Donna, to... Is that your phone going off?
No, it's okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's all right. To the concept that I develop in my book, Heart of Being Helpful. I don't know if you've seen the heart, but it's very much when I talk about healing.
One of my favorite books.
Is it one? Of course, as you read it, and I remember you read it in your training program.
Yeah.
Of course. That was one of the highlights of my life when you told me you read it in your training program. But I mean that. It was really very touching for me. But the idea of healing presence, that we find in ourselves a healing presence that we create that helps the person with us feel more healed or simply more loving toward themselves and others and kinder and gentler. But a healing presence, and I think that's very close to what your students were learning through the mindfulness program. One of the things I continually emphasize for therapists is the idea you don't have an emergency when your patient is having one. And if you really don't have an emergency inside yourself, your patient's emergency will calm down. Whereas if you act like it's an emergency or even feel like it's an emergency, the patient's going to get even more scared because, my God, it's so bad you're having an emergency. And that psychiatrists continually go the opposite direction. The patient says they're suicidal. The psychiatrist doesn't relax and say, well, tell me about that. We can handle that. Psychiatrist gives a drug, or the therapist, unfortunately, recommends a drug or something along those lines. So this real coming together of the ideas of mindfulness and my own approach, I think I've just learned it in a different way, which is interesting. And one of these days I should get inspired to take a mindfulness training program.
Well, as you point out, there are many roads that lead to Rome. And knowing your work over the years and also my own mindfulness practice and the study of mindfulness and meditation and Buddhist psychology, yes, I mean, so much of what you say and what you espouse is a mindful awareness of one's own existential reality. And when you enter into the room with a client and are calm with them and are not activated when they're activated, but are empathic and present, as Carl Rogers would say or be, with unconditional regard and curiosity and a keen interest and compassion, then that's a huge healing for someone. Then they know that it's okay, you know, and they don't have to fix themselves. You're giving them space to sit in the existential pain of what's true right now. And if we don't feel like we need to run away from that, then just like any boogeyman in the closet, it goes away. It calms down. And so the work that you've been doing over all these many years of understanding that you can't solve an existential problem pharmacologically is very, very important. And I think mindfulness does dovetail with your work. And, you know, I consider myself a mindful therapist. That's what it says on my business cards. and to help people have and live a mindful life is really what you do, you know? How do I stay mindful? How can I be responsible for my experience right now? And the one thing I think you might be able to see from all that we've discussed today is that if a person's able to be a samurai warrior of their own amygdala response, of their own fight or flight response, then they are going to be able to be more present and kinder to everyone with whom they relate because they're not activated. And, you know, I think this is a fundamental skill that clinical psychologists and social workers and therapists need to have. That's why I am, you know, my soapbox is that all therapists should have mindfulness training so that they're able to stay present with clients' experience without the overlay of their own, you know, to be able to just enter into that space and to not shut down, to be mindful in their work. So that's what a lot of my work is about and my publishing.
You're actively a psychotherapist. How do you integrate this from the viewpoint of teaching the client, not yourself, but the client? How do you integrate this in both face-to-face work and if you're doing telephone work?
Well, you know, as you wrote in your book, you know, I think it's really about the heart of connection. You know, it's about just being able to be present with another person in a particular space. So whether I'm doing a session, you know, whether I'm talking to someone in person or I'm having a conversation on the phone or what have you, it's really just about hearing the person where they're at. I mean, isn't that what you do?
Certainly what I try to do, sure. Mm-hmm. I also then try to nudge them sometimes a little bit in directions that I think are better for them. And that way I'm a bit of an activist as a therapist. Actually, I'm more than a bit of an activist. So I try to be there with the person and then look at the world from their view and perhaps help them see something a little more clearly or understand how the past is getting in the way of their being able to be more loving, more caring, more present. So I'm active, but I'm there with the person, hopefully. Your thoughts?
Right. Yes. Yes, nudging is a very important thing, too. But you see, that nudging comes out of authentic presence, you know? If you're authentically present, then you can sort of offer any of that up, right? Because
Yeah. People are grateful, especially if they know they can disagree with you. And if they're strong enough to disagree with you, especially, then they can listen to another viewpoint that seems to recognize their viewpoint and suggests maybe a happier viewpoint that they could develop.
Right. Yes, or a more clear viewpoint.
Yes, definitely. That's better language than happy. I actually discourage people from pursuing happiness directly. I think that leads to drugs and other things, sex and other things that aren't necessarily going to turn out right. I think that one pursues a way of life that is good and worthwhile, decent, kind, loving, and then nature and God willing, it leads to happiness.
Well, right. Because, like, I happen to think that, sort of like I heard this Woody Allen line that everybody's already happy, only they don't know it. You know, so I think in the same way, like, everybody's already enlightened, only they don't know it. And I think that the core of our being, our natural state, is joy and happiness, and my interpretation of that is gratitude and appreciation and awareness that life is impermanent, that this moment and this moment and this moment are precious, and I'll never have them again. And it is, I think, our natural state is gratitude and appreciation, the spirituality that you talked about before. This awareness, the state of awe, and entering into grace, being able in real time to see that this life I'm living is a gift to me, even with its limitations. And I don't know, I just sort of feel it kind of in my right in my, right above my stomach, right below my chest, like right in the core of my being, my chest area right below. I just feel a sense of just joy, you know, that we get to talk to each other, Peter, you and I, that I get to hang up and go for a walk outside and look at the sky. You and I walked together in Arizona. I remember we had the most wonderful walk. I'll never forget that walk.
Yes.
And that was a joyful experience in my life that I hold so sacred and dear, pure, you know. And I think that all of life is really that way when we can peel back the layers of confusion, of discursive mind, this churning, it's rumination, right? To ruminate is what a cow does with that cud in its mouth, right? Chewing it and chewing it and chewing it is rumination. And mindfulness helps us stop all the chewing, the chewing, the chewing on the same thing. I think one of the things that scared me and was the greatest wake-up call for me was realizing that I was going to waste my entire life in this, in all these thoughts, and I was going to be like 89 years old and realize I'd missed it because I'd just been churning on all these thoughts, all of these, you know, accusations, these hurts, these notions, and I was missing the very present moment. So this practice really just helps us appreciate and have greater gratitude. And I think, you know, you've seen all these new studies, these psychological studies and research studies on gratitude and how much it's helping people get over depression and anxiety. They're having people write down what they feel grateful for. And why does that work? Is it a pill? It's not a pill. But it does the same thing as a pill. It activates the part of your mind and your brain, which is the reward center, because you're feeling grateful for being alive, for having your health, for being married to this person, for having a child like that, for having found Ginger in this life. And we, you know, there's a sense of awe, of gratitude, of appreciation. That is wellness. That makes our brains react in ways that are fundamentally healthy, that are fundamentally pointing toward what is well-being. Well-being is joy. Well-being is being in the present moment. Well-being is appreciation, gratitude, and understanding this moment is precious.
You've been using a lot of language that I use all the time for myself and sometimes other folks. And a lot of it touches on very spiritual aspects of life, gratitude. I think you even used the word grace. I think that escaped from your lungs. Do you have a whole, I just don't recall now whether you have a mostly secular view. Do you believe in God? Does God play a role in this? What are your feelings about all that?
Well, to me, it is extremely secular. Because for me, I keep talking about the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex.
Yeah, that's why I think I can't remember you talking about that.
So I feel that is grace. You know, I feel that is God. When I see the color of a geranium, and it's so drenched, I think that's a miracle. I think that's God. I'm like in awe of that. That's to me, you know. And grace is being able to transcend our, as my mentor Clark Moustakas used to write, in the context of research and how to be a valid researcher, if we're able to transcend the ordinary nature of mind to access this more transcendent awareness, I mean, is that, to me, that's secular. Transcendence is secular because all it means to me is that we're able to stop feeding ourselves on our old racket and that we are more present in the moment and able to experience this. So I don't know, you know, it's so funny. Even listening to myself, I think it sounds rather religious, but to me it's just science. it's just, you know, stopping all this internal chatter that does us no good. So if that's spirituality and that's transcendence, then so be it.
I actually have a more concrete experience of spirituality for myself, in the sense that I do feel that there is a force, a power, some sort of essential goodness that is actually active in our lives, and that much of what we even think is our own doing is actually something that's been guided. And I came very late to that idea. I was the class agnostic in high school in the 50s, so I was always ahead of my time. But I actually have a real sense of an active presence in my life that is a spiritual quality. I don't know whether there's an entity that's identifiable as God, or whether it's something about love infusing the universe. I mean, I don't pretend to have a cosmology or a theology. I just have a sense of what people call God as a loving intervention in their lives. I really do experience that. Have we ever felt that?
Well, I agree with you completely. I mean, that's what I think is God to me, is love. It's just when we are able to be in the presence of love, to me, that's what that means. And
you don't feel that there's a maybe purpose in your life that's been given to you from outside yourself? That, to me, is kind of a key aspect of my life.
Mm-hmm. I know that when I'm sitting in the room with people and talking to people, I know that I love that. And that time disappears. I know that happens when I write. So those are the kind of clues I use of what God is, I guess you would say. And as far as religion, I would say kindness is all that really matters. It occurred to me like a while ago that when the consciousness of two people can lose their boundaries, and both people sort of have a merging of their minds, that is the height of what can be accomplished on this earth. And maybe that's what peace is. But someone wrote a book about Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who started Shambhala International and was one of the first in the Naropa Institute in Boulder, and was one of the first Eastern teachers to come to the West. But they describe being with him as a merging of minds, a mixing of minds, you know? And when you're fully present with another person, whether it's in the therapy room, as either client or therapist, or in a love relationship, or having an incredible conversation with an incredible person who's bagging your groceries at the store, or for me, I love talking to Uber drivers now. I think they're just amazing people. And they're some of my best memories of being to this particular city or that, was the amazing engagement I had with the Uber driver. Like, to me, it's just whatever's magic. And wherever I feel my heart sing and an incredible connection. And you and I had that from the first, you know, moment we met.
Yeah.
And I just really appreciate that, and I just think it's so wonderful. And it just is what I feel gives life meaning. And it happens in the therapy room, it happens here, it happens there. And it is what human potential, I think, is that, to be able to do that, to transcend what's good for me. What do I need to do for me right now? And to just be present in the space with someone, to have a curious mind, to be engaged. You know, I don't know if I get part of this from when I was a very little girl. We lived in Wayne, New Jersey. I don't know if I told you this. It's in my master's thesis, though. But the house I grew up in had a lot of conflict in it. There was a lot of parental arguing. And so I used to sort of ditch out of the house through all those years and just hang out in the woods. We had woods in the backyard. And so I just found an incredible peace in the woods, and everything made sense in the woods. You know, in the spring, buds would bloom. In the fall, leaves would decay and drop. Everything was peaceful. Everything made sense. Little bugs crawled on the ground. Birds flew. It was really idyllic in the woods, and I would look out from being in there to the house where all the fighting was, and I would say, wait a minute. When I'm in the woods here, everything is pristine and beautiful, and I would always describe it as that I had found God in those woods. Peace, God. And then I would look out at the house, and I would say, the problems must be in there, because when I'm in here in the woods, it's, I don't yes. feel that pain. But when I look out at that house, that's where it is. So by sheer deduction and mathematics, I figured out it couldn't possibly be me, because it would have come with me into the woods. But it wasn't there.
That's beautiful.
But God was there. God was there. And that's I feel beautiful. Like I still carry that with me, and that's just what I hope to bring into the therapy room, is that the woods are everywhere. And the story is that, you know, I had my life, I got married, I had that big career, type A, and then I started a meditation practice at the Shambhala Center in New York, and I went up and sat on this cushion, and shockingly, like 30 years later, all those feelings of the woods, the pristineness, the preciousness, the awareness came back to me on the cushion. I had lost it. And I was like, oh my goodness, look, I found the woods again. It's on the meditation cushion on the sixth floor of a Manhattan high-rise.
You know, I think a lot of people, this could help a lot of people go back to those moments, because I think many, many people have that sense in childhood of a separateness and a connection with nature and a separateness from the misery. I know when I was much too young to be on my own, I would, while we were near, we had a beach club that was near what is now a state park. It was giant sand dunes. And I think I was like 5 or 6, and I would go wander off for hours into the sand dunes and play and be on my own and meet the critters. And from then on, I always felt my connection with God through nature. And I'm only now, in my older years, able to feel that connection in a town like Ithaca, to walk through a town with people in it and houses and certain dangers around, and to feel that connection with God. Because for me, it, other than with Ginger, it was nature from when I was a little child. Any parting thoughts? What do you
think? Yeah, that would be my parting thought, actually, is I do believe that all of life is the journey back to rediscovering that childhood awe and that yeah. connection with self and the world before we became inured to the sacredness and the miracle of this very life, of this very moment, of this very relationship. We knew it when we were children, so I think that is the journey, you know, to rediscover our curiosity, our beginner's mind, our basic goodness, and our heart space, the love that is that I say is underneath just all the confusion that are these thoughts and these feelings and these emotions, but that underneath it all, we're already happy only we are not able to find it in this moment. But, you know, they talk about the analogy of being on an airplane, and it's so incredibly cloudy. But then as you break through the clouds on the ascent, you see that the sun was shining all the time, only you couldn't see it. So I think that life is very much like that.
The part of it that I still puzzle over that is for me an internal contradiction is that I also felt very young that I was here in order to make things better regardless of how difficult. And that is part of what looks to me like a power greater than myself sort of nudging me in a particular direction. And it's not something I see a lot of people feeling in particular, but it presents a dichotomy in a way, because on the one hand, there is the joy of connection and and having a clear mind and a loving mind. And on the other, there is the impulse to do things that are just terrifying. Do you have any thoughts on that in the last 2 minutes?
Well, yes. I think that we all need to be able to live in a peaceful state and also bring out our own norma ray, and to have meaning and purpose in life. And I think you're an advocate for well-being, and I think many of us are, and I don't think one thing negates the other. I think that your life work is underwritten by making sure that people don't suffer. You're a bodhisattva. You are here on this earth to eradicate the suffering of other people. It's what you were as a child and who you are today. And there are many of us like that. So I guess it's about finding our own inner bodhisattva and to settle our minds so that we can be free to help other people not suffer. And that's what you do. And I hope that's what I hope to do in some context or the other.
That is put so beautifully. You are becoming more and more eloquent. That was just beautifully put. Folks, we're talking with Donna Rockwell. You can find her easily on the internet, and I urge you to go and to do so. Donna, it's just wonderful to spend an hour with you.
Same here, Peter. I love you forever and always. And love to Ginger, too.
Yes, our love to you, and just call me sometime and say, I have stuff I want to talk about on the radio again.
Sounds good. It's a date.
It's a date. It's a date. Thank you very, very much. And thank you for listening, folks. Thank you for listening. I really hope that Donna's presence brings you some greater understanding. I really, truly hope so. Bye-bye now.